From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. It is Friday, so that means it's time for our reporter roundtable, and we have got a lot to get you up to date on. So let me introduce our panel. Dawn Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Kelsey Mosley Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun, Andrea Olson, a reporter with EastIdahoNews.com, and Alex Duggan, investigative reporter with KTVB in Boise. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hello.
Happy Friday.
So I want to start, Dawn, about what's going on with Kroger and Albertsons. So let's break this down. Can we start with what's going on with it? We've spoken briefly on our program about it, but if folks aren't familiar, these are what, the two biggest grocery store chains in the country?
Yes, depending on how you define grocery store chains.
Okay.
Albertsons and Kroger rank number two and number one. Kroger's number one and Albertsons number two. I set myself up backwards there. And but that's just when you consider supermarket players. Walmart actually sells more groceries. That may be important as we go along here, but regardless of how you look at it, they are two massive players in this space for the food you and I buy each day to feed ourselves and our families.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so with that said, Dawn, will this merger actually happen? If it does, I guess, when are we looking at that? But then also, what kind of ramifications does that have for Idaho? Because Albertsons is not just based in Idaho. I mean, it was started here, founded by Joe Albertson. There is a long history.
Yeah, there is a really long history here. And if I had a crystal ball and could tell you if it would happen or not, I would quit this job and go buy a whole bunch of Albertson stock. We don't know. And I think it is a really key question. This merger would put together these two chains. It's a, I believe, a $54 billion merger. And all in, the two companies own more than 5,000 stores. When you talk about any time you're going to put together two big players like this, it can invite a lot of scrutiny. And we're already seeing that, frankly, faster and more furious than I thought we would see it. The Federal Trade Commission, really under the last three administrations, Obama, Trump, and now Biden, has expressed a lot of skepticism towards big corporate mergers of all kinds, but particularly in the retail space. The companies are coming out and saying, you know what, this is necessary to compete. Walmart, like I said, sells more groceries. We've got the threat from Amazon coming. But the FTC often looks at these not on a global basis on how it looks across the nation, but how it looks in each individual market. So even here in the Boise area, we use the word Kroger, but people more commonly know Fred Meyer. Fred Meyer is a Kroger brand. Those two chains, the Albertsons chain and Kroger, own a pretty significant piece of this market. And it's frankly probably worse in terms of concentration in a market like Seattle, where they own Fred Meyer and Albertsons, but they also own QFC, Safeway, and Hagen. In that market, they control more than 40% of the share of grocery prices. And as we were digging through this, I was looking at some of the history of Albertsons and what's happened. And there's kind of something interesting here. A few years ago, Albertsons purchased Safeway. They put those two, frankly, fairly large chains together. And to satisfy the government, they said that they would spin off about 160 stores to a Bellingham, Washington company called Hagen. Hagen had trouble operating those stores, sued Albertsons, saying that they weren't being cooperative. And then Hagen filed for bankruptcy and closed. And guess who got all the stores back? Albertsons. So you look at a market like Baker City, Oregon, which I think is right on the edge of your broadcast territory. Mm-hmm. They have just, there's just two grocery stores in that town. They're both on the same street. One's called Safeway. One's called Albertsons, but there's very little difference. And we actually went and looked, okay, what do the prices look like between these two stores? And they're identical. So if you want to buy a carton of milk at Albertsons, it's going to be the same as the Safeway across the street. And if you live in Baker, Oregon, and you want to go to a mainline supermarket, that's your only option. There is like a grocery outlet in that market and a small co-op, but really for the supermarket array of products, you don't have another choice. And so this is going to probably cause some scrutiny from regulators. And what's important here and what's happened this week is we've seen lawmakers come out and express some fairly high skepticism. The first was somebody who might not surprise your listeners, Bernie Sanders. But the second was Mike Lee of Utah. Now, I don't think I have to tell anybody that Mike Lee and Bernie Sanders, a conservative and a democratic socialist, don't generally see eye to eye. And we've had some others, Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, and a number of others say that they have concerns. And a key judiciary panel in the Senate has said they're going to hold hearings on this. So there are definitely some questions. So that's a lot. The second part of your question is, what does it mean for Boise? We don't know. If the merger goes through and is completed, there are a couple of scenarios that could play out. One, the Albertsons and Kroger have said that they would spin off like 100 to 400 stores into a standalone company. It's a fair bet that, that standalone company could be based here in Boise. I also talked to a really smart insider this week who'd worked for the company for a long time, and they provided some insight that was essentially the jobs that are in Boise for Albertsons now are harder to replace. And Kroger's the kind of company that kind of has its people spread out across the country. And so you could see maybe those jobs staying here in Boise over the long haul. We just don't know right now. And the companies aren't saying, they aren't saying where it's going to be headquartered. They're also not even saying what the company's going to be called. They do say, and this is important, that your local stores, if they if this merger goes through, will not change names. So you won't see Albertsons being called something else or Fred Meyer being called something else. But all the behind the scenes things are still very much to be determined.
So, Don, what does this mean then? Let's say for, as you mentioned, I mean, Walmart, you know, sells more groceries, they're cheaper. But how about Winco, another Boise-based grocery store who, you know, I mean, for, unless you've got some good coupons, you spend less money at Winco going grocery shopping. I mean, I think they must be sitting back just kind of, I mean, are they thinking this could be good for them?
Yeah, and Winco actually definitely almost always is able to undercut Walmart on price, which is very rare. Albertsons takes, and this gets into the weeds a little bit, but Albertsons takes what they call a high-low approach to selling groceries, which means they'll have some things on sale that will probably be cheaper than what you can get at Winco to get people in the door, but they make that margin up by selling other goods at a higher rate. Whereas Winco uses a strategy called everyday low price, which means they try and price everything as low as they can. So yeah, like you mentioned, you can get some deals at Albertsons, but shopping there every day, it's probably going to be more. Winco has benefited from Albertsons being based here for a couple of reasons. One, there's an ecosystem that is built up in the Boise market from third-party companies like Procter & Gamble has an office here, for instance, because they can service both Albertsons and Winco. They also have been able to benefit from the fact that talent can often go between the two chains. So you might work at Albertsons for 10 years and go work at Winco. So there are some things there that are kind of interesting where these two kind of grocery powerhouses being based here has benefited probably Winco and Albertsons to some degree too. We'll see what that dynamic does if these things change going into the future. Winco isn't really a target for takeover and really never has been because they're employee owned and it insulates them to some of the pressures that Albertsons feels as a company that's controlled by private equity and is publicly traded.
So I know, Don, you don't like to give opinion, but I am curious if you were as surprised by how quickly the backlash came about with this potential merger. Because when I first read about it, I mean, I have to say, I was like, okay, another merger. But then as I read more about, there's this idea of potentially, I mean, not a monopoly, but it certainly could impact grocery prices. I mean, it does make you start wondering, but I have to say, I was surprised by how quickly the backlash happened on this.
My sense is that the companies are a little surprised too. This deal is really complicated, but they expressed a lot of confidence that would happen. I listened to the investor analyst call with Kroger CEO Rodney Mulhern last week, and I've listened to a bunch of these, typically not for Kroger, but for Albertsons and for Micron and for some other companies. And the analysts all seem very skeptical and asked a lot of pretty pointed questions of the Kroger folks about the merger. The stock is a little under what you would expect for this. And I don't, they knew they were going to have trouble with the FTC. There's no surprise there. Mm-hmm. I think they might be a little surprised at some of the Senate action. I can't speak for them. But I do think that it's perked up more quickly and with more force than I thought. I looked at the deal and I will tell you, so we've been tracking this for a while because Albertson said in February they were doing a strategic review. We've gone so far as we've been watching jet patterns to see where
people, right.
Albertson's executive, literally, we haven't reported on that but it has given us some kind of indication. The summer they said they were going to look at selling the real estate. So when this was announced, I actually did an analysis piece in April and I was like, okay, what are the possibilities here? And I was like, it ain't Kroger, folks, because they're too big. Like, that was my opinion back then, based on the factors. And so when this happened, I went, huh. And so I was a little surprised at it, but I'm not an expert. I'm not a government lawyer. I'm not, I can just watch tea leaves. So I was surprised when I first heard, but over the weekend into early this week, it was pretty clear that there are some cross currents here that I think are stronger than they expected. The deal very well could still get done. It also could get done where they say, yeah, you know what, we're going to have to sell like 1,500 stores or 2,000 stores, mm-hmm. but we're still going to take the best pieces. That could happen too. We just don't know. But one of the signs that Kroger and Albertsons thought that this was going to be complicated is they say this isn't going to close until January of 2024, which means they think they need a full year and almost 4 months to get through the process, which is a really long time for any merger. But a merger of this scale, I think that they know that it's going to take a bit. The next thing we're going to be watching here, one, there's apparently going to be Senate hearings next month, and I expect them to be contentious. Two is what comes out of the Federal Trade Commission and what indications do they have about where they're looking at the deal. And we'll know that within the next couple of months as well.
Mm. All right. So much to keep our eye on this. Before we go into a break, Kelsey, I want to have you come into the conversation. Talk a little bit about what is going on with one Idaho legislator in particular who's planning to bring a bill this coming legislative session that would, basically prohibit public drag shows?
Yeah, he's not a legislator. He's actually a lobbyist.
Okay.
From the Idaho Family Policy Center. His name's Blaine Kanzati. He has been part of the bills for abortion restrictions over the last couple of years. The Idaho Family Policy Center used to be the Idaho Family Policy Alliance, and they are mm-hmm. nationally affiliated with a couple different groups, including Focus on the Family. So he's been around for a while doing those things, and now he's kind of getting into this space. They've been kind of critical of drag story time at libraries, and they got involved with the Coeur d'Alene incident with a drag performer who was supposedly exposing himself at a Pride in the Park event. And according to video footage, he was not. It looked like it was edited to make it look like he'd exposed himself. So they've been involved in this battle for a while. But when the Boise Pride event got a bunch of press last month, because people started complaining about a drag kids event performance, mm-hmm. they got involved in that as well and started circulating a petition to have some legal action around this. And I think he's very involved with several legislators, but he wouldn't name them. He also wouldn't share the draft bill text for me, but he told me that it would prohibit drag performances at public venues such as parks and libraries, places that are funded by tax dollars, basically. So things in the park, things of that nature, things at the bars and things, and that they can't really control. And so that wouldn't be part of this, but he said it will not be a violation of the First Amendment. He said it would be legally defensible, but I'm not quite sure what the basis is for that. It sounds like it's going to be based on a section of the Constitution that's about how legislators have an obligation to promote morality. And so I think that's what they're basing it off of. But a lot of people's reaction was it's still a freedom of speech violation, a freedom of expression violation to ban certain performances from public venues. So it will be interesting to see the bill text when it actually comes out. But they said it's going to be introduced in the very first days of the session. And so it's a high priority from the sound of it.
Well, and Kelsey, here's a part of this that I'm wondering about. What about Okay, so it's public spaces, right? Okay, what about places like the Idaho Shakespeare Festival? What about places like Boise Contemporary Theater? Where, let's take Shakespeare, for example. I mean, let's go back to when Shakespeare first started. I mean, there were only men on stage and they played women, right? And we even see that now with performances at our own local Shakespeare Festival. I mean, if a bill like this passes, I mean, what would be potential repercussions of that? Because you could very well say, well, that's a public space. And, we've said, I mean, drag is drag. If someone is a man and portraying a woman or a woman portraying a man, does that count?
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I wish I would have had the bill text, is because I'd like to see how they're defining what drag actually is, because that will be really important for those questions. But I fear this is another one that, if it does pass, will be challenged immediately in the courts, and I'm not sure how it will fare. So it's probably going to cost the money to defend again. And I don't know where that line is going to be drawn. I don't know how you define what drag is. Because, for people who don't know, it's just a performance mostly of somebody putting a bunch of makeup on or wigs or some pretty flowery outfits and lip syncing to songs for the most part. And so I don't know how you define where that line is. And when I talked to a couple different drag performers who have been performing for a decade, they said, it's an art form, and it's a way to express yourself in a community that, where you might feel more yourself than in other places. And it's no different than a clown for entertaining a crowd. Mm-hmm. And so are our clowns a problem now too, So it's going to be an interesting debate.
It's been around, and drag's been around for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Alex, your station did an investigation into the complaint surrounding former Boise Police Chief Ryan Lee. After your investigation was published, the mayor asked Lee to resign within 24 hours of this being published, we should say. So tell us what happened last week when Boise City Council members finally were able to read these 9 complaints against the former chief.
Yeah. So Patrick Bajan spoke to me about kind of the path moving forward. And to be honest, he kind of told me that there really isn't any policy and procedure, like really precise policy, to investigate a chief of police. Like it's just not etched in stone. It's very vague. And especially when officers come to an entity to complain about someone in a command staff unit. So it's kind of, he told me it's a gray area basically. And that the council is working through this. They've actually looked over all of these complaints. They've read them. Obviously most of them, like the names and stuff, are redacted, but they read through the accusations, they read through those things, and Bajan told me that essentially these policies get murkier and more challenging as you get up to the higher levels of leadership, and it's pretty confusing. So they're basically trying to sort out like the murky waters, like just kind of maneuvering through that they know that there needs to be clear policies, and that's just what they're working towards.
Mm-hmm. Dawn, you and I have been around for a very long time, and both of us just means we have a lot of history. But we remember when there were other issues with the Boise Police Department, to the point that a full-time ombudsman, Pierce Murphy, was brought on in 2000. He was here for 14 years, and I keep thinking, as I'm learning more about what happened with former Chief Lee, is what would this have looked like if we still had this type of position? Because this is where, police officers, other personnel for the city could go and make these complaints, and investigations would take place.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. Pierce Murphy was brought in under the administration of former Mayor Brent Coles, and it happened because trust in police in this town was very low. There was a number of police involved, and I hate using that phrase, but I'm going to use it here. Police involved shootings, both where mm-hmm. police had been shot and police shot others. And confidence in the force was shaken. Frankly, I think we've seen some of that in recent years, nationally and to some degree here locally. And Pierce Murphy came in, was brought in by the mayor and council, and was a pretty strong office for a long time. And I think won public trust, did the job for a long time. When he left, the city under then Mayor Dave Beter left the position open for quite a while. And then they decided that they were going to eliminate the office of ombudsman and instead put in an office of police oversight. But the office of police oversight was going to be part-time. The person they hired was going to work half-time and not really be as, I would say, fully staffed is probably just the best way to put it, as the ombudsman's office was. And so it was a weakening of that oversight function. After Beter lost to current Mayor Laura McLean, that model was taken off the books, and a new Office of Police Accountability came in with a full-time director, Jesus Jara. And they also changed that the police oversight, police accountability office, I should say, was required to bring a quarterly report to both the mayor and the council. And so that report now comes to Mayor McLean and City Council President Elaine Clegg. And so we've seen some changes. What's been interesting about this story is what role did each piece of the city play? So there's internal affairs, there's the Office of Police Oversight, and there's HR. And I had a fairly extensive conversation with the mayor about 2 weeks ago on this. And, you know, she just kind of said, yeah, there was definitely some balls dropped here. You know, we as the public don't know what's in those 9 complaints. I think that reporters would love to see them. It's not going to happen. They're personnel records, right? Ryan Lee was asked to resign after Alexandra's story came out. And the mayor said, she told me, and I think she told other outlets a similar thing, like, we knew that there had been trouble with the chief for quite a while. And this story made it impossible for him to continue to operate. And it's kind of a hair split. She didn't necessarily say that what was in the story was the problem. It was the fact that people now had this knowledge and it changed the perception in the community. And she said that she found out that the union was also trying to coach him, that meant it was time for him to go. There's still a lot of question here. And I don't know that we're ever going to fully get all the answers to what happened because of the messiness of personnel records. And I think a lot of people have done a lot of work to get a lot of light on this, primarily Alexandra, frankly. But we still have questions.
Well, and speaking right, to, and I go ahead.
Sorry. Sorry. No, go ahead. I was going to say, speaking to the OPA office, I mean, I spoke to the former part-time director and she told me that she was frankly very confused by the situation because, you know, HR was typically the place that people go to voice complaints, but then it was alleged that they were turned to the OPA office or IA and then the OPA office. And so she kind of thought that it was like a confusing situation as well. And she said in her experience, like, this probably wouldn't have happened if, you know, she felt that the office is less independent now versus when she actually worked there because they changed the ordinance. And so what Dawn was saying, they kind of disbanded what she was working in and then formed the new office. So she felt that the office is less independent now.
Yeah. And I think that cuts both ways, right? I think part of the challenge, Pierce Murphy's office was known for being pretty independent, both from the political side and the police side. Now I think there's some questions. What is the OPA too close to the police? Too close to the mayor? Maybe both. And that's what we don't know. You know, when you read the plain text of the ordinance on the OPA, it says that any person can bring a complaint to the OPA. But does that mean a citizen or does that mean an employee? And that language isn't clear. We don't know. And Alexander set it up very well, that there just doesn't seem to have been a process for complaints against the chief. And I think mm-hmm. you have to look at the political undertone of all of this. Did you have a police force that was frustrated with the political direction set by the mayor and council, and frustrated with a police chief who was doling that out? I think you have to consider that. We're in the middle of union negotiations with the Boise Police Union. But you also have to consider that what we haven't mentioned here, that Ryan Lee was involved in an incident last November where he injured an officer in front of other officers. An investigation was launched. It went to the Idaho State Police, and there's a tort claim against it. And when you read the Idaho State Police investigation of what happened with Ryan Lee, while the accounts from the officers in the room vary, there is definitely a tone of at very least discomfort with his actions, if not more. I've talked a lot with our senior reporter, Margaret Carmel, about this story, and there's a lot of yes and to this. There are things that both can be true. This can be a political problem. This can be a police union problem. And this can be a police chief who maybe made some mistakes. It isn't necessarily as black and white as some stories we cover are.
Gray area, very much so.
Yeah. And I think too, I mean, Dawn, the reason why I wanted to talk about kind of the history, right, and going back to Pierce Murphy, is that I think if there was this idea that, oh, Alex and KTVB put this story out, so therefore it got into the public purview, so therefore the public, you know, will now question the police. It's like, no, we were questioning this department 20 years ago, right? Questioning the city 20 years ago. There is a history in this city and in this department. That doesn't mean that things haven't changed and things haven't evolved, but there is a history there.
There is a history, and it is one of the most political, the police and fire unions are both political organizations. And in the fire union case, especially spends a lot of money supporting candidates. And in the last political cycle, both the police and fire unions were big donors to Mayor Dave Beter. Mayor Dave Beter didn't win. Lauren McClain is now the mayor. And, you know, how they feel about the current mayor, we don't really know. We'll probably be able to see it in the political donations this coming cycle. But there is always going to be a push and a pull between elected leaders and the police force. And that's not just true in Boise. That is true everywhere.
Everywhere.
Mm-hmm. They aren't always going to be in alignment. And when you overlay the fact that we're in the middle of a police contract, Mayor McClain told me that the union and the city mutually agreed to put that on pause after Ryan Lee was asked to resign. There's just a lot to it. It's not just this simple little case of like, I mean, maybe it is, but it's probably not just, oh, Ryan Lee's a bad guy, or the cops don't mm-hmm. like him, or the cops are mean, or the mayor's bad, or the mayor's good. Those things aren't that simple. It's like if you were a kid and you had the string and you wrapped it around your finger, and you like made the little cradle. Was that called a cat's cradle? And you have all the little strings going back and forth between your hands. That's what this makes me think of, because there's all these little things that go back and forth. And it's like, well, this might be true, but that might be true. And you know, reading Alexander's report, reading Alex Barzi's reporting at the Statesman and doing our own reporting and talking to sources and talking to people, you kind of get this sense of like, boy, I don't know that we will ever 100% know the real truth. I just don't think we mm-hmm. will.
Right. As you said, shades of gray. Andrea, thank you for being so patient with us. I do want to get over to East Idaho now. You have a lot that you've been reporting on recently. And one thing that actually made not just headlines here in Idaho, but national headlines, and that is of a Rexburg man who was killed while fighting in Ukraine. Can you talk to us about that? Because your organization was able to actually speak with his mom.
Yeah, so I think a lot of people actually talked to his sister. I was able to talk to his sister and his mom and learn a little bit more on her side, what it was like with him growing up. So he's this 34-year-old man, and his mom is calling him that a hero, and also he has a warrior's heart. He just died recently on October 11th while he was in Ukraine fighting alongside volunteers. And as we know, Russia launched a full-scale invasion on Ukraine in February. But what I found really interesting was from his mom, Terry Hepworth, and the man who died is Dane Partridge. They grew up in Germany for part of the time. He was born there. Mm. And she said that they were living there at the time because her husband, Dennis, was an air traffic controller in the United States Air Force. So they were stationed in Germany from 1987 to 1991, and they went through all sorts of things like Desert Shield and Desert Storm, as well as the fall of the Berlin Wall. So Dane, her son, ended up living around armed guards and search dogs. Like, this was his life. This was really common for him to see men in gas masks and uniforms, and they were always on alert for attacks. So then finally, when he was 3 years old, they transferred back to the U.S., and he's crying for months. And she's like, what's wrong? And Dana's saying, I want to go home. And she's like, well, you are home. And he said, no, I'm not. And so she says, well, then where's home? And he's saying it's back in Germany. He's saying he wants to go where all the soldiers are. And so when she moved to Rexburg, because Terry and her husband ended up getting a divorce, she took Dane and wanted him to get away from that war mentality and tried to get him into the cowboy world, because over in this area, that's what we know. But she unfortunately could not get him away from that. And he took anyone under his wing. Anyone who needed help, he would always go out of his way to help. So actually, after when he turned 18, his father signed him up in the U.S. Army right out of high school. So he served from 2006 to 2012 in different places like Colorado, Washington, and Iraq. And while he wasn't in the Army, he worked in Bonneville County for a trucking company. And then suddenly, you know, fast forward, he hears what's going on in Ukraine. So he decides that he wants to go. He has a wife and five kids, and he ended up leaving in April of 2022. So he was there for some time, and he ends up meeting people from Idaho while he's over there, actually, which is really cool. But he ended up joining the International Legion of Foreign Fighters, which is a group of volunteers from countries around the world fighting alongside Ukrainians. And then he was also involved in an organization called LEGS, which is Logistical Emergencies Getting Solved, which was helping to organize rescues of injured civilians in Ukraine. And so his mom was telling me that she would sometimes talk to him in Ukraine. And at one point in time, before he was actually critically injured, he was hurt. She said that his foot got caught on a tripwire, and then he got shrapnel fragments from the grenade that went off. But once he got healed, he just went right back out. And then he video chatted his mom in Rexburg and said, and she said that he looked super happy. He was smiling. He was peaceful. He felt like, you know, this was what he was meant to do. And then that was it. And she told him that she loved him. And then suddenly he was wounded on October 3rd. And that's what landed him in the hospital in critical condition. His mom, Terry, got a message from a church member there saying that he was wounded. And she at first thought they weren't bad, but then she had a feeling they were. And then his sister, Jenny, told us that Dane was with other men when they were clearing trenches in Ukraine when they were ambushed by two Russian vehicles. And then the men were caught in a firefight, and he got shrapnel in his brain and suffered from a broken neck and an injured arm. So anyways, he ends up landing in the hospital, and he is on life support, and it was just too much. Terry was saying there's just no way that he would have come out of that okay. And so they were going to make a decision to take him off of life support. But actually they didn't have to make that call because there was legal issues, but he suddenly just slipped away on his own on life support. And she said that the Ukrainians loved Dane a lot. And so that's a little bit about Dane. And Jenny just says that he was a great man. And she had talked to him about 5 days before he was critically injured. And he just wanted to know what was going on at home and tell everyone that he loved them. So now they're kind of in the process of bringing his body back because his body is still in Ukraine. And they're hoping they can, you know, somehow get his body back soon and bring it to the Idaho State Veterans Cemetery in Blackfoot, Idaho, where he can be properly buried because his family said that is where he wanted to be buried.
Thank you for you know, giving us this story about him so we're all aware of who he was and what he did. Kelsey, we are less than 3 weeks out from Election Day. I know one race that's getting a lot of attention is the race for Attorney General. The two candidates actually debated. So what did we learn?
From the debate or from my profiles?
Your profiles.
kind of the same things, but...
Yeah, exactly.
I had a follow-up interview with Tom Marcouche, who's the Democratic nominee, and Raul Labrador, who's the Republican nominee, and just kind of talked to both of them more at length about some of their views. And it's from my profiles, it's, you know, it's pretty clear that Tom Marcouche is just in the race because Raul Labrador is in the race.
Right.
And he, you know, he's pretty candid about the fact that if Lawrence Wasdin, who's the current attorney general, was still in the race, then he wouldn't be running. But he thinks that Raul Labrador is going to make the office into his own personal war room for cultural issues. And he does not think that's what the office should be used for. So he kind of talked about that. And recently in the last week, a lot of different Republicans have come out in support of Marcouche over Labrador, including former First Lady Lori Otter, senators like Patty Ann Lodge, who has worked for the Republican Party for 66 years, she said, and former Secretary of State Benny Sursa. They all came out and endorsed him because they think it's important to not have that office turn into something more of a political animal. And there was also a press conference yesterday, I think it was, of a bunch of law enforcement officers who felt the same way, including former Ada County Sheriff Gary Ramey and another one I'm not remembering, but that's pretty significant. I don't think I recall seeing that in attorney general races of the past. I mean, right. We've had the same one for many years, so I wouldn't really know, but it's been interesting to see how many people, I think 50 Republicans have come out in favor of Marcouche. But when I talked to Raul Labrador, you know, he takes great offense to people saying that he's going to put politics above the law. He's just clear about the fact that he thinks the attorney general can be a partner with the legislature and to help them pass laws that will hold up in court and make them constitutional. And this attorney general that we have right now has not been that kind of attorney general. He's been more of a, this is the law, this is what you should do, or not what you should do, but this is how you can stay in compliance with the law. The law is written that you've got, that you want to pass, is not going to hold up in court. That's just my opinion. Do what you want, you know? Whereas Labrador is saying there's more that we can do to help the legislature pass laws that will hold up if they're challenged. And he said the left is very good at this. They do the step-by-step process to get things that they want done. And so it's pretty hard to square that with his statements that it's not going to be a political office, but right. He says that that doesn't mean he's not going to follow the law as written.
I think this is a race to watch for sure. So
yeah.
Election day on November 8th. So Don, Micron has unveiled its plans for its expansion. And we're not exaggerating when we say it's a lot.
Yeah. It's all in all, it will be about the size of the Pentagon, So if you want to get a kind of a feel for how big that is, the Pentagon is still the nation's largest office building. This isn't going to just be an office building. It'll be more to it. The centerpiece of this is what's called a fab. That's where they'll make the chips and have a large clean room. That's going to be 4.85 million square feet of space.
Holy cow.
It'll be 160 feet tall. 4.85 million square feet, I believe, will be the largest building in Idaho by a lot. Mm-hmm. You might remember the Amazon Center in Nampa a few years ago. That's 2.6 million. So this is quite a bit bigger than that. The building itself will be 160 feet tall. That's as big as the Idaho Power Building here in downtown Boise.
Wow.
And then there's all these other pieces, an administration building, a building with support areas, a utility area. It's going to have its own gas plant, which will have a kind of a smokestack type structure that's 185 feet tall, an on-site water treatment facility, an electrical yard. It's a lot. We have tried to contextualize how much is $15 billion. And so we went and looked at the total value for every building permit issued in the city of Boise for 10 years. And that number is $8 billion. The numbers are so hard, bigger than it's hard to say. So in the city of Boise, every single building built over the last 10 years, the value is $8 billion. Micron alone, for all of it, everything, houses, office buildings, improvements, whatever. $8 billion is a lot. Micron says they're going to spend not quite twice that, $15 billion, all on their own in 7 years. So that can give you some feel for the scale that they're going to build almost twice as much as Boise has done in the whole city in the last 10 years, and they're going to do it quicker. And so it's almost hard to wrap your head around. In our story, which is up on the homepage at boisedev.com, we've tried to give some perspective. So as you go through, you can be like, oh, okay, this is like that, this is like that, which helps to ground it. Because as I look at it, I just go, yeah, this is big. How big? I don't know.
Just super big. Don, I only have about a minute left. So with this expansion, though, do we know how many jobs this could bring in or create?
Yeah, Micron Technology has said that they will hire 2,000 people directly, but they have said that their total jobs impact will be 17,000. They have not said how they get to that number. It's my belief that that is a mix of like vendors and direct support, but then also this kind of chain on effect. If you have 2,000 or 3,000 people here employed by Micron, it means you're going to need more gas station workers and more people to work in restaurants and et cetera. So I my guess is that 17,000 is all the jobs that will be created by their economic impact. Either way, it's a lot of jobs.
It's a lot of jobs, and that's a big domino effect. Yeah. I want to thank all of you for your time today. My apologies for not getting in everything that that you guys sent, but I do appreciate all of you so much. We've been talking with Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Kelsey Mosley Morris with Idaho Capital Sun, Andrea Olson with EastIdahoNews.com, and Alex Duggan, investigative reporter with KTVB in Boise. Give their stories a read, folks. This is some good good journalism we have in the Valley and throughout Idaho. Thanks, everybody. Hope you have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Idaho Matters. From Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette.